Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. I am delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week the author of an amazing new book about the war that the Vietnamese call the American War and we call the Vietnamese War, quite possibly one of the most important books that will be written about that war. It's called Kill Anything That Moves. Nick Terse is also the author of The Complex, How the Military Invades Our Everyday Lives. He is also the managing editor of TomDispatch.com, which you should read every week. And his investigations of U.S. war crimes in Vietnam have earned him a Ridenour Prize, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and a fellowship at Harvard's Radcliffe Institute. Nick Terse, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you so much for writing this book, Kill Anything That Moves, which makes a case that our common understanding of what happened in Vietnam is radically off, that we think of a war that was fought as a noble, fair, sportsmanlike war with a few aberrations, a massacre or a war crime by a bad apple here or there. That's not the picture you present, is it?
No, it isn't. There have been, approximately 30,000 books written on the Vietnam War, but there wasn't one that really attempts to tell the story of what I came to see as the signature aspect of the conflict, which was Vietnamese civilian suffering. Millions of Vietnamese were killed or wounded or made refugees by deliberate U.S. policies, like the use of almost unrestrained bombing and artillery shelling across wide swaths of the countryside. That's deliberate policies dictated at the highest levels of the U.S. military. And this is what I really found lacking in the literature and what I wanted to try and correct.
How many millions, when you say millions, of Vietnamese?
Well, we'll never know exactly how many Vietnamese civilians died in the war, but the best estimates that we have indicate about 2 million civilians died. Add to that about 5.3 million civilians wounded, using a very conservative method of estimation. The U.S. government came up with an estimate of around 11 million Vietnamese made refugees during the war. And the latest studies show that as many as 4 million Vietnamese were exposed to toxic defoliants like Agent Orange. So you have suffering on an almost unimaginable scale.
It is very, very difficult to imagine. Just to be clear, how are we distinguishing civilians from non-civilians? Because presumably were our nation being bombed, we wouldn't think it was okay to kill whoever resisted it, but impermissible to kill whoever sat back passively. What's the distinction?
Well, again, this is all done through estimation at this point. There weren't really good methods for tracking during the war. There's been the most comprehensive study that was done by researchers at Harvard Medical School and Washington State University, and they did extensive surveying in Vietnam and came up with a grand total of 3.8 million Vietnamese who died during the war overall. So they tried to make a differentiation there between armed guerrillas, armed combatants, and the civilian population that was living in the countryside, which was, mostly women and children and elderly men.
There of course has been some coverage at the time and ever since of particular atrocities in Vietnam, such as the My Lai massacre. Your claim is that the My Lai massacre was not unusual; that this was a rather typical massacre. Is that accurate?
Well, there were many, many more massacres. My Lai is maybe atypical for two reasons. One, the amount of civilians killed at one time. We're talking about 500 civilians killed over a period of just 4 hours. So this was atypical in some ways. Most massacres were smaller. But the other atypical thing was My Lai was the only massacre that was really rigorously investigated by the U.S. military. This was the one that, they weren't able to keep the lid on it, and then they put together a very comprehensive means of investigating. They they created a panel called the Pierce Panel after the general who headed it, General Pierce. And this panel came up with all the wrong conclusions as far as the military was concerned, because Pierce, in investigating My Lai, found out that on that same day, the very same morning, another village close by had another American patrol go through there and carry out another massacre. We'll never know how many people were killed in the village of Mikkei, but somewhere between, say, 50 and 150 Vietnamese civilians were killed there. So this is going on at the exact same time as My Lai, and it really it put the lie to the military's contention that that My Lai was a great aberration. If a different unit in a different village was carrying out a massacre at the same time, it indicated that this was much more pervasive than American people had been led to believe, and I think even that the military quite realized. So this was this other massacre was hushed up, and then the military never investigated any other massacre in the same detail. But in files that I found, they did know of other massacres, and they certainly could have investigated many more.
How widespread were the practices, even at a smaller scale, in given instances, of slaughtering the innocent, of killing the elderly and the young and women and those clearly not engaged in combat?
Well, this went on really on a regular basis in Vietnam. I should say that that most Vietnamese were not killed in My Lai-style massacres. This isn't the way that most Vietnamese lives were lost. Most were killed due to, deliberate U.S. policy, but things that were promulgated on a much higher level than one low-level officer ordering his men to gun down villagers. We're talking about unrestrained bombing, artillery shelling, the use of helicopter gunships that were basically given carte blanche in the countryside. The title of my book, Kill Anything That Moves, that's an order that was handed down a lot in country, and one that I came to see as a shorthand for the war, because in many cases, the military created what they called free fire zones. This was a legalistic term that the military came up with to justify the way that it fought the war, and it basically opened up, wide swaths of populated areas to almost unrestrained fire. And this is how most Vietnamese died.
Now, there were those, as in more recent wars, who came back as veterans and whistleblowers and tried to speak out and tried to make some of the crimes they had seen or participated in known. And in some of these cases, they believed they had been ignored, that the military had disregarded what they had to say. And you managed to discover that, in fact, the military had looked at complaints, conducted investigations, produced reports, and then buried them. This is an incredible revelation. How did you find this information that produced this book?
Well, I really stumbled upon it. This happened when I was a graduate student. I was working on a project on post-traumatic stress disorder among U.S. Vietnam veterans. I used to go down to the National Archives and try and find hard data to match up with the self-report material, what veterans told us about their service, when and where they served. And on one of these research trips, I just had hit dead end after dead end. Every research avenue that I pursued was a bust. And on my last day, about 2 weeks, a two-week-long trip, and I on this last day, I went to an archivist there that I normally work with, and I said, look, I can't go back to my boss empty-handed. I need something, at least a lead, to take back. He thought about it for a moment, and then, he said a few words that really changed my life. He asked me if witnessing war crimes could cause post-traumatic stress. And I told him I thought it was an excellent hypothesis, and I said, what do you have on war crimes? And within an hour, I was going through box after box of materials. To call it an information treasure trove is the wrong phrase. I mean, this was really a horror trove. It was thousands upon thousands of pages of reports of massacres, murder, assault, torture, rape, mutilation. It was a horrific record. that the military had put together. This was a secret task force that was convened in the Pentagon that was designed to track war crimes cases in the wake of the My Lai massacre. The idea was that the military never wanted to be caught flat-footed again by an atrocity scandal. So this task force tracked all the allegations that bubbled up, and whenever it could, it tamped them down. And this is really how I began the project, because I quickly realized that these cases weren't generally in the literature anywhere.
Understanding that we're speaking with Nick Terse, who is the author of this amazing new book, Kill Anything That Moves. Understanding that the majority of the deaths were brought about with airstrikes, the killing on the ground, as you describe it, evolved during the course of the war, and there was even a movement away from imprisonment toward murdering people rather than detaining them. Is that how you see it?
Well, you know, the war was fought using an attrition strategy. This wasn't a classic World War I type war where you had two armies facing off on a battlefield. The Vietnamese revolutionaries were fighting a guerrilla war, and the Americans were looking for, you know, they weren't out there to take a capital or control territory. So they were looking for a metric to show that they were winning. And for the attrition strategy, the metric was body count. Basically, the idea was that you would kill your way to victory, that you would pile up Vietnamese bodies. And this meant that the Americans were always chasing this crossover point where they would be killing more Vietnamese guerrillas than the Vietnamese forces could put into the field. And at that point, they believed the Vietnamese would sue for peace. They didn't quite realize the Vietnamese saw this as a continuation of their anti-colonial struggle against the French. And they didn't see this as a rational exercise. They were nationalists looking to win their independence. But aside from this, the U.S. only had this one metric really to go by, body count. So troops in the field were pressed. They knew they had to bring in a body count. Their commanders demanded it. They knew that their life would be tougher without it. They'd be kept out in the field longer. They'd be exposed to much more danger. So there was there was great pressure put on them. And, you know, I chronicle in the book that a lot of times a junior officer would call in that he'd captured a suspected enemy or even a confirmed enemy fighter and say that he had a prisoner. And, a superior officer would call back on the radio and say, you know, I don't care about prisoners. I want a body count. And as a result of this, the prisoner would be shot, would be called in as the prisoner shot trying to escape and be added into the body count. And this happened with civilian detainees, and happened with civilians even who weren't detained. Just about any Vietnamese who was killed was called in as an enemy killed in action, and commanders didn't ask questions about why there weren't weapons to turn in. You know, that presumably an armed guerrilla would have. You were supposed to turn in weapons if you claimed a body count, but. American commanders became less and less discerning over the course of the war.
So you find responsibility high up in the ranks, I take it. Where do you find the ultimate responsibility? How high up for the airstrikes and for these policies, which predictably led to what we call war crimes?
This would be at the highest levels of the Pentagon. This is where all these policies really flowed from. And I think it was impossible for the Secretary of Defense on down, and I assume it had to be known in the White House as well, that these policies made it inevitable that large numbers of civilians would be killed. And I even, in Kill Anything That Moves, I do cite documents that show there was a widespread knowledge of this. From the earliest days of the war, I chronicle a 1962 document. This is before most Americans even knew their country was at war in Vietnam. That there were, advisors there, a general, in fact, who said that, the policies that are being instituted, this widespread use of firepower, are going to cause immense civilian casualties. So it was known from the earliest days of the war. and it was recognized until the last days that the simple application of American firepower, the very way that the Americans fought the war, was going to cause immense suffering across Vietnam.
What about responsibility in our communications system, in the U.S. media? You describe, among other cover-ups, Newsweek magazine having a major story and burying it. What responsibility lies there?
Well, in the book, I do mention that prior to My Lai, there was a study done by some very meticulous researchers who found that there were 3,000 reports of American violations of the laws of war that had appeared in mainstream publications, newspapers, magazines. So there was evidence out there, but the problem was generally that there was no context given. There'd be, you know, an account of torture taking place, Americans torturing Vietnamese detainees or prisoners. But those who read the articles weren't given the information that, you know, the type of torture that was being documented there, something like a water torture, that, you know, say the Japanese prisoners during World War II who applied this were tried afterwards, received long prison sentences, or were executed for this type of thing. There wasn't, Americans weren't given this type of information, so they kind of got the impression that this was, you know, this is the way the war is fought, war is hell, and they weren't given, you know, the full details to make make an informed decision about what they were reading. So there was that going on, and then, you know, at other levels, there were cover-ups going on in the press, mainly stateside editors who got reports of large numbers of civilian casualties. They weren't inclined to publish these types of stories. There was self-censorship going on in Vietnam. Reporters, I've talked to reporters and read accounts where they said that, you know, if they came back from the field with a story that civilians were being killed, you know, it'd be, you know, there'd almost be a laugh because it was sort of that this was well known, but these weren't stories that got in the paper. It wasn't a revelation to people who saw this on the ground, but this wasn't the narrative of the war that was being told. I think that one of the most telling things is that when the My Lai massacre took place, there were somewhere around 500 reporters in Vietnam at that time, but not one of them got this story. When the story was reported from Vietnam, it was basically a rehash of a U.S. military press release, which called My Lai a major victory, 128 enemy soldiers killed at a cost of no American lives. No one thought to ask, how is it that you'd fight a hardcore enemy unit and not have, you know, one American lost, and you'd kill 128? But nobody asked those questions. It fell to a stateside reporter, Seymour Hersh, to actually blow the lid off My Lai. Well over a year later, those in country just they totally missed that massacre.
And yet we have this notion that the Vietnam War was the first televised war, that Americans back home saw the horrors and saw the suffering of the civilians visually before them in their living rooms in a way unprecedented before or maybe even since, and that there was this impact of the media. How accurate is that memory?
Well, I think it is right on some level. There was much greater access during Vietnam. Reporters did have the ability to get out in the field in ways that, with the embedding process today, just isn't possible. But a lot of times, reporters, they were, in some sense, embedded with these units. They were out there with American units most of the time. These American units were on their best behavior. Generally, if reporters were with them, but you know, there was a chance for, you know, these iconic images like the execution of the prisoner during the Tet Offensive, or the quote unquote Napalm Girl, that glimpses of the real war, were able to get out. So there was I think there was better access on some levels there, then again, you mentioned before the Newsweek article. This was it was an investigation of, you know, a massive, large-scale war crime. Of you know, Newsweek estimated that it was 10 times the size of My Lai. It was an operation called Speedy Express, and I eventually found documents that showed that this the military believed that Newsweek's estimate was a low-end estimate. They said up to 7,000 civilians were killed during this operation. But Newsweek had this story, and they really had the military dead to rights. They, this was the stuff of Pulitzers and congressional investigations. But the editors in New York felt that the White House and the Army had been through so much as a result of the My Lai massacre. They thought it was, you know, and this is the words of one of the top editors there, they felt it was unfair to put the military and the White House through this again. So they severely truncated the story, and what could have been, I think, a turning point in coverage of the war passed by with only a ripple of attention. So there were a lot of factors at play, which helped to you know, keep the worst aspects of the war secret.
It's hard to know whether to laugh or cry. The media had decided that reporting on the infliction of massive human suffering would cause too much suffering to the United States military. That was their judgment.
Yeah, it's a very troubling judgment. And another thing I should mention was that you know, but before My Lai, when atrocities were reported, there wasn't much context, and then My Lai came about, and there was this brief window where atrocities did make the newspapers and magazines, but it closed almost immediately because it was felt that, you know, okay, we had My Lai, you've heard this story before, and somehow atrocities went from, you know, not being mentioned to being old hat, and there was only this very, you know, slight blip in between. So, yeah, this was, you know, it's very troubling. There are a lot of questions to be asked of the media from that era.
I hate to ask a historian who's done all of this careful reporting to speculate, but I have to. What do you think this lack of accountability among high officials, among within the military and in the media and other places of power resulted in? That is, what crimes that we have seen since Vietnam might not have been had there been. Had there been an accounting at the time?
It's a question that's really you know, plagued and troubled me. But I'm able to draw upon an expert that I talked to. I mentioned this Vietnam War Crimes Working Group, the task force in the Pentagon that put together these records. I talked to he was a colonel at the time when he worked with these records, and he retired as a general. And he told me that at the time he kept these records secret for what he believed was the good of the country and the good of the military. He believed that it aided the war effort, and it was best to keep these things covered up. But he told me that in the years since, you know, he reflected on it, and he came to believe what he had done was wrong. And I talked to him while the Iraq War was still raging, and he said to me very plainly that he felt that if these things had been aired at the time, then maybe the Abu Ghraib torture scandal, which was going on at that very moment, that you know, might not have occurred. Now, of course, you never know with these what ifs, but he was of the belief that if we had an honest accounting at the time, if there had been real soul searching, if he hadn't kept these records secret, then you know, maybe atrocities from the current wars could have been avoided. And he felt that it was a real failing on his part.
How do you, looking back, how do you compare the damage, the loss of life, the injury, the trauma, the creation of refugees, the environmental damage, the damage to the structure of law and politics and on of Vietnam compared to other wars, more recent wars? How does Vietnam rank in our scale, the horrors that we've inflicted on the world?
Well, as you know, I have studied today's wars, and I have to say I don't think the killing of civilians by U.S. forces today is near the scale of the carnage in Vietnam. I think specifically the ways that artillery and air power are used at least as far as I know, they're radically different. But that said, you know, civilians still die on a regular basis in our war zones, be it Iraq or Afghanistan, and many due to violence set off by America's invasions and occupations and the resulting civil strife. And, of course, others have been killed directly from U.S. bombing, from helicopter gunships, from troops on the ground. Still more have been wounded. Others have been made refugees. And despite the efforts of NGOs and the United Nations and others, I don't think we have good numbers on the civilian toll. You know, we're still trying to figure that out. But we know there's been immense suffering, and if history is any guide, I'm afraid that it might be decades before someone is able to put together the real story of these wars, let alone the semi-covert campaigns in places like Pakistan and Yemen. I think it's going to take some time before we can really start to grapple with the civilian consequences of those wars.
When we look closely at wars like the most recent war on Iraq or Afghanistan, we see endless similarities to the horrors that you report from Vietnam. We see orders that are the equivalent of kill anything that moves. We see rules of engagement that evolve to meaninglessness. We see gang rapes. We see murders. We see mutilation of corpses. The whole litany. Is the problem that this simply is war, or is the problem that we haven't sufficiently cleaned up war and made it civilized? That is there some core element of war that doesn't include so-called war crimes? Or are we eventually going to get to the point where we understand the phrase war crimes to be a redundancy, to be essentially crimes?
Well, I'm not sure that you can ever remove war crimes from war, or that you can really divorce civilian suffering from war. I think this is it is really a natural consequence of wars. I think there are ways to perhaps fight wars in ways that would protect civilians more. But on some level, I think it's always going to be a futile effort because at least since World War One, civilians are the primary victims of warfare. I mean, this is really what has become a modern war. And I just don't think there's any way to get away from that. Civilians are the ones that are going to suffer.
Final question. We're almost out of time. Do you think the military is still producing reports on its atrocities and hiding them? Do you think there are horrors remaining to be dug out of the National Archives?
Well, I spent the last year actually trying to get an embed in Afghanistan to see the military's civilian tracking system, a civilian casualty tracking system. This is something they've set up in recent years, but I wasn't able to get to it. I tried to embed with multiple units that are involved in it, and they wouldn't let me take a firsthand look. And I know from talking to at least one other reporter who follows these subjects, he wasn't able to get in there to see it either. So we know that the military has data that they aren't interested in sharing with the public right now. So I think it's going to be it's going to fall to some scholar down the road to take a look at what records they're producing today.
Nick Terse is the author of Kill Anything That Moves. Nick, thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks so much for having me on.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. All past shows can be found at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. Until next time.